Well, for our listeners at home, as we say, talk to the students in class about the quiz that I gave at the beginning of class. So we're on slide 6 and we're talking about aliasing. So we refer to this distortion as aliasing. So if I take a signal that's not band limited to B hertz and I sample it, what's going to happen is I'm going to get these replicas of the spectrum. They're going to overlap, and therefore there's going to be some distortion introduced. The actual sampled spectrum, and I'll show a better plot of this in a moment, is going to have distortion where these two overlap. And that's essentially the trade-off that had to be made when they chose the CD sample frequency. So they decided to set the sample frequency a little higher and to gradually low-pass filter the signal between about 20 kilohertz and 22 kilohertz. So we'll come back to that in a moment, but let's talk a little bit about sampling of narrowband signals. What is the lowest sample frequency we can use for a narrowband signal? So we have this signal shown to the right here, and when you look at that signal, you might think, well, I have to sample that signal at twice B2 because B2 is the highest frequency. But if we think about that, if B1 and B2 are kind of arranged carefully, if you recall, the sampling process essentially takes the spectrum and replicates it. So we can actually derive a generalization of the sampling theorem that says, as long as we can sample that at a frequency where these things don't overlap, we might actually be able to sample that signal at less than twice B2. And in fact, a good guideline is that the sample frequency has to be greater than B2 minus B1 in this case, which means we can actually sample that signal at something less than B2, but it really depends on the amount of real bandwidth there is to that signal. Now, there's some caveats to this. There's actually a derivation, and we can talk about things having to be integer multiples of one another and such. And I won't belabor that point in this semester, but the gist of it is when you sample that signal, it's going to take this thing and it's going to replicate it. So if replicas of this fall in the right places, you can actually get back a baseband version of that signal just by sampling it. And this is another thing that's done in radios, in, for example, digital radios. You can just demodulate a signal just by sampling it, if you arrange the frequencies properly. So sampling can also be thought of as a modulation operation, since it shifts a signal spectrum and frequency. So let's talk now a little bit more about aliasing. So on the top there, I have a signal which has an asymmetric spectrum. The magnitude spectrum is not an even function, so actually this is a complex signal, complex valued signal, but I will use it to demonstrate the concept of sampling. So if I take that signal and I sample it at f sub s equals 2 times b, I get replicas of the spectrum spaced every 2b, and things work out nicely that the overall spectrum looks like this. It's packed very tightly, but there's no aliasing. If I set the sample frequency to 2.5 times b, all that's going to do is move these replicas out a little bit, so I actually get a little bit of a dead zone between the corresponding spectra. And like you said, that's sort of what they did with CDs. They created a little bit of a dead zone, so you didn't need a really very sharp low-pass filter. However, if I undersample the signal, if I sample it at 1.5 b, then what happens is I get this kind of overlap, and the composite spectrum actually looks like this. And that signal, you can see, is clearly a distorted version of this signal. So this is not good. Though, in some applications, we actually are willing to live with a little bit of aliasing to save bandwidth and save disk space and those kinds of things.
What kind of application would that be satisfactory in?
of speech recognition. You can actually recognize speech even though it's distorted like this. And you're going to save computation because you're operating at a lower sample frequency. We don't do that, but that was considered in the early days of consumer toys. We used to we were building things like yes-no recognizers for a game, and we were asking questions like, well, maybe if we only sampled at 1,000 hertz and just let the signal alias, when there were sounds that had frequency content above 1,000 hertz, like they would just alias back into the baseband, and you'd still see the sound, and you could still recognize it. It just has a distorted spectrum.
Don't they like deliberately alias some signals? Like in radio, you can move things back into baseband. Like
I don't remember all these applications, but yeah, there are applications in communication theory where they deliberately alias, from what I remember.
Like, how does that work? Like, why would you how can you take a sample and then, like, move it from, like,
Well, the example I just cited was, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if this is the spectrum, and this is your sample frequency, and it just so happens that your sound has frequency out here, you don't really care that this gets aliased back into the baseband as long as there's nothing here to distort it. And it turns out when you make a sound like S, or SH, most of the energy is up at a high frequency. There's very little useful low energy.
Okay.
So from an audible standpoint, it sounds terrible. It actually doesn't sound so bad because S's sound like noise over the phone anyway. But from a pattern recognition point of view, it doesn't really influence things too much. Over the years, tried to play a lot of games like this. DSP designers are good at, you know, these kinds of trade-offs. And that's one of the things that makes all this fun, is you have to be pretty creative, much like in circuit design, because ultimately you want to minimize compute resources and all those kinds of things. Now, one thing I want to keep driving home this semester is that even though this is ECE's Signals and Systems course, the principle of sampling applies to many, many different applications. I mean, you can even talk about, you could even apply it to football games and things, but here's some examples of other types of sampling. Obviously, with video displays, you have spatial sampling issues. And in fact, with video displays, you can play with either making the samples in a rectangular grid or making the samples in a hexagonal grid. And that's something that's actually done in some systems. And now you essentially have the ability, you have to talk about frequency in multiple directions, because you have a frequency content in this direction, a frequency content in this direction, and frequency content in all the other directions as well. And there's actually a two-dimensional version of the Nyquist sample frequency, a Nyquist theorem, that tells you what the minimum spacing must be to get perfect reconstruction of the video signal. CD players, you might be familiar with switch capacitor filters. They are rooted in this concept of sampling. Biological signals, you know, all biological instrumentation these days is pretty much digital, and they have to worry about what's the right sample frequency for an EKG signal or an EEG signal. Digital blood pressure products are now on the market. And then you can also talk about a really interesting example, the stock market. Suppose you're trying to predict the price of stock tomorrow. Do you want to sample the Dow Jones Index once a day, once an hour, once a minute? If you ever watch the Dow Jones Index in real time, it bounces around a lot. It's actually not a good thing to watch. I can tell you, sometimes when I'm at the gym and I'm watching it, it's not a good thing to watch the Dow Jones Index in real time. It's like, whoa, 200 points! And, you know, because somebody somewhere in the world decided to make a decision and boom. So there's interesting questions about how often you sample signals like that to be able to process them. Full motion video signals, we talked about at the beginning of the semester, are sampled in the X and Y direction on your video screen, but they're also sampled in the temporal dimension. And this relates to how fast you can represent motion, how fast you're sampling in time. Commercial broadcast television operates at 30 frames a second. HDTV operates at 60 frames a second. And if you want to go even higher, I don't know if you've ever seen these cameras that catch like bullets impacting devices and water droplets hitting. These things run at tens of thousands of frames per second.
Time warp.
Yeah, that is awesome.
It is.
Somebody had a question?
I did. You don't have any idea why RGB never really caught on in the U.S.?
I don't remember the story on that, but there's always a lot of politics in those days between Europe and the U.S. on standards and all that.
Standard on European and Japanese TV.
Yeah, so European uses the PAL standard, and we use the NTSB, NTSB or NTSC or whatever.
NTSC.
Yeah, and
NTSB is the voice.
There's a similar issue with what's called ALAW and EULAW companion speech for audio. Europe uses ALAW, US uses EULAW. Most of this was politically motivated. And, well, it's you have to remember this was done in the era where there was a Cold War, so.
Yeah. We got to have better TV than the Reskies.
No, different TV. I mean, the thing was
actually worse TV. RF is horrible compared to RGB.
Now, another thing that we can do with the concept of sampling is we can actually downsample and upsample. I don't want to say too much about this. You study this more extensively in DSP, but this is another example, I think, of. You all do this probably every day with your little computer tools and your MP3 players and things, and you never really think about what's happening. But it's possible to actually take a digital signal sampled at one frequency and produce a digital signal sampled at another frequency. And you can do that actually very computationally efficient, through a process where we essentially take the digital signal, zero stuff it at a higher sample frequency, then we low pass filter it, and then we remove samples to get back to the new frequency. So the final frequency, the final sample frequency is a sort of a ratio of your up sample frequency and your down sample frequency. And this has been used extensively when you want to convert signals. So for example, if you want to go from 8 kilohertz to 16 kilohertz, that's fairly easy because you're only going up by a factor of 2. But if you want to go from 44.1 kilohertz to 16 kilohertz, that's more difficult because 16 and 44.1 don't have many good common factors between them. And since so much audio information was made at 44 kilohertz, this is one of the reasons why some of the early Macs used 22 kilohertz and 11 kilohertz as their sample frequencies. Because they just wanted to make it easy to convert down from 44.1. But in telephony, we use 8 kilohertz. This MP3 player actually digitizes at 16 kilohertz. And then also can play at 44.1 kilohertz. So that the process of going between these frequencies uses this kind of a process. And the interesting thing about it is instead of doing this using sync function based interpolators, you can actually approximate this using simple process of zero stuffing, low pass filtering, and then decimating or removing samples from the signal.
Is this how a conversion works, like on the DVD players that I've converted to 1080i?
Possibly, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
This is a well-known algorithm, and it works well if the frequency you're starting with and the frequency you're ending up with share some small common factors. Like you can go up by 3 and down by 4, or up by 5 and down by 6. It doesn't work so well with 44.1 because you have to go up by 128 to get to a round number so that you can then go down to like by 64 or something, and that requires a lot of additional computation. Now, another really interesting example of how we can combine all of these ideas to produce high-quality audio is the concept of oversampling. And this really revolutionized digital signal processing because we were able to finally build converters that were very, very high quality, that would give you signal-to-noise ratios that were competitive with the best analog stereo systems. And the principle behind this is really simple. Well, it's sort of simple, but it makes use of a lot of concepts from both analog and digital signal processing. So CD players use an oversampling approach that involves sampling the signal at a very high rate and then downsampling it to avoid the need to build high-precision converters and filters. That's in a nutshell what they do. Now, from a signal processing point of view, what happens is, if you remember, the signal is band limited, right? The signal that you're trying to sample is band limited. Now, what have we said all along about what contributes to high frequency content in a signal?
Fast changes.
Fast changes, right? So if you sample the signal at a really high rate, what can you say about the change from sample to sample?
It won't be very much.
So what oversampling converters try to do is to essentially sample the signal at a very high rate and then only encode the difference from sample to sample using one bit. Either the difference is plus or minus. And then to reconstruct the signal at the other side, you simply have to accumulate all these differences. So when they were talking about 4x, 8x, 16x, 64x, it referred to essentially to how high they were sampling the signal, how much higher in frequency they were going. And the higher you go, the fewer number of bits you need to encode the differences. So you could go up by 2 and use, let's say, 8 bits to encode the differences. You could go up by 4 maybe and use 4 bits. Or you could go up by 128 and use 1 bit. And this turned out to be a much, the overall result of this was much better in terms of signal-to-noise ratio than what you could achieve using other techniques for implementing analog-to-digital converters. So this took over the market, and eventually you had very sophisticated A to D converters that were using a lot of digital signal processing inside of them to get this, to implement this kind of an algorithm. I added one more slide on this. So this is also based on a principle called delta modulation, which is formally what we describe as the process of taking a signal and transmitting the differences from sample to sample rather than the actual amplitude. So if you think about this from a mathematical point of view, you might have a signal that varies like this. Well, this signal would need a large number of bits to transmit this difference, right? Because you're going to have 2 to the n levels. And how fine those levels are going to control how much precision you can represent this amplitude as. However, if we remember that this is a band-limited signal, it can only change so fast, we should be able to sample it at a high rate and then only encode this difference. Well, that difference has a much smaller range than the amplitude. So I can actually use m bits, where m is less than n, to represent that signal. So this process was first applied to encoding a voice, and you may have encountered some of these voicemail systems that sound pretty awful. They'd use 16 kilobit delta modulation. That was one of the early implementations. a number of consumer toys use this process because it turns out, again, you can reconstruct the analog signal by simply taking, what you do is you take these differences, you use a technique called pulse width modulation, where the distance between pulses is proportional to the amplitude of the signal. And then you take that signal and you just apply it into a cheap low-pass filter. Cheap low-pass filters are really good. Cheap low-pass filters are essentially integrators. And what comes out through the magic of DSP is actual audio signal. So this concept was used extensively to produce the earliest generation of digital consumer products. And today it represents state-of-the-art in terms of analog-to-digital converters. So what we've done today, you know, the two main results today, I would say, are learning, understanding what frequency you have to use to sample a signal, and then understanding how we can actually reconstruct the signal. We talked about the Nyquist sample theorem, we talked about the spectrum of the discrete time signal, and then we talked about different ways to reconstruct the analog signal, one using the sync function interpolation and the other using the low-pass filters. And then we briefly touched on some popular applications that use these concepts of sampling and oversampling and downsampling and things like that. Okay, I will see you on Monday.
So did you actually give some kind of quiz at the beginning of class?
So it's one of my little unannounced deals is that